You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Ken. Thanks for being here. For 160 years, Boys and Girls Clubs have navigated times of crisis to provide safe places for kids and teens. So we're zooming in on the work of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County as it provides food and programming support during this pandemic. How have you seen family and friends and neighbors help each other during this time? Do you rely on the Boys and Girls Club for childcare? How are you managing right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Michael Johnson is president and CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. Michael, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thank you for having me on this morning.
Well, when we last checked in with you about a month ago, you had raised just shy of $1 million to help in this pandemic. How did that fundraising turn out?
It's turning out great. As of this morning, we raised about $2 million in partnership with United Way and Selfless Ambition. And we've distributed those funds to more than 50 nonprofits throughout Dane County. So it's going extremely well so far.
Are you feeling like you're moving quickly to be able to get the funds to the nonprofits that need them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the fastest I've ever seen. You know, we were a little surprised when we originally kicked off this campaign. The goal was to raise $50,000. And then within, 24 hours, we raised $250,000. And within 72 hours, we were at $500,000. Within a week, we were at $1 million. And then within a month, we're at $2 million. And so I'm thankful that more than 1,000 donors throughout southern Wisconsin has contributed to this fund. We've gotten those resources out to nonprofits, in the community, and we're seeing them do amazing work so far.
How is the Boys and Girls Club spending these funds? Where are you putting these dollars?
Yeah, so let me just give you a quick update. So far we've paid the bills of more than 150 families across Dane and Walworth County. We're partnering with Feed Kitchen and Second Harvest. We're providing more than 500 meals per day to families in need. We awarded funds to local colleges and universities to support students who are having hardships. And we just last week donated, with the generosity of one of our local car companies here, a used electric car to a local student here in town. We started a campaign to feed first responders. So every day we've been feeding police officers, firefighters, nurses, and first responders, making sure that they're getting a healthy meal every single day. This morning, we're delivering 500 pounds of food to the Catholic Multicultural Center with the CEO of Sarah Cycling, and we're doing that on electric bikes. And so we're just trying to do, our part with other partners to make sure that those who are impacted, by this pandemic, that we're leveraging, our collective resources to make sure people are getting this support right away.
You mentioned they're working with 150 families to help pay their bills. How do families find you? How are you able to connect?
Yeah, so I would encourage people. Yesterday, United Way of Dane County, we released $1.5 million yesterday through their fund. And they released, if you go on their website, you will see all of the agencies that were funded. We would encourage people to reach out to those organizations. Many of them have their own process. There's also on the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County website, the agencies that we funded with their email addresses and how they're helping people. So I would encourage people to go to both the Boys and Girls Clubs of Dane County website and the United Way of Dane County website, and you'll see those 50-plus agencies who have secured these funds and how they're helping people during these challenging times.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Michael Johnson. He's CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. We're checking in on the efforts of his organization during the pandemic, what outreach is going on. With your questions about volunteerism at 800-642-1234, how are you lending a hand during this crisis? How is it going? Or if you know of a group that needs help, what is it? How can the help be provided? Join in at 800-642-1234. Michael, I imagine that it's a pretty tricky time to manage volunteers when there are multiple organizations trying to blend resources. How is that going?
Yeah, I would say we've tried to be very, very careful around that. So we have used, you know, some volunteers to work with the restaurants to deliver meals to first responders, and then we also are delivering meals at all three of our Boys and Girls Clubs and working with groups like Feed Kitchen to have volunteers to support with that. So, for example, just last Friday, we partnered with Local 311, the firefighters, and a restaurant called Gino's, and we gave away, we fed 500 people and was surprised by the number of folks who came out. And so we've tried to limit the number of volunteers that we have, and we're pretty much utilizing, you know, our staff. But there are other groups like, you know, Feed Kitchen and Second Harvest, the River Food Pantry, that are in need of volunteers. We're leveraging our support to make sure that we have people who are donating resources towards these efforts. So we started a campaign called Move for BGC. And Move for BGC, if you Google it, it's a campaign to feed first responders, to feed kids, and to also help us raise money to provide virtual programming for kids throughout Dane County.
What types of virtual programming are you trying to provide children right now?
So we kicked it off yesterday. If you go to the Boys and Girls Club's Facebook page, the virtual program is going to be around educational support and providing online tutorial support for young people, and also supporting virtual programs that the school district put out. A lot of people don't know, but we have about 50 paid tutors that we have in the public school systems. We're the only nonprofit that I know of that have paid tutors in the classrooms working with teachers every single day. So we want to redeploy our people to make sure that we're providing that online support. We also will be doing cooking classes online because we want our young people and our families to be eating healthy while they're sitting at home. So we'll be bringing on chefs to do Facebook Live videos for our families to make sure that they're getting that support as well. Our sports people will be interviewing different professionals around how young people can get involved, you know, in sports and how to stay healthy as they play sports, whether it's in their backyards and when they come back to school. So we'll be doing a variety of different things like that to engage not only young people, but their families as they sit at home during this pandemic.
We're talking with Boys and Girls Club of Dane County CEO Michael Johnson is with us. We're looking at the work of his organization during these difficult times. Does your child rely on Boys and Girls Club programming? What services do you want this organization to provide right now? How have you seen family, friends, and neighbors rally around each other? What are your stories like? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Michael Johnson right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're checking in the efforts of the Boys and Girls Club amid this pandemic. The Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee said last week that they had handed out 44,000 meals at three sites so far. Along with food, they passed out learning packets, crayons, but the organization scaled back to one day a week for safety reasons. Do you rely on the Boys and Girls Club? What do you need from the organization right now? What could help you get by during this stay-at-home order? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Michael Johnson here, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, and he stays with us. You know, Michael, one of the missions of the Boys and Girls Club early on was to help stop the number of latchkey kids, kids who were returning home after school with no parents in sight. And, you know, that was a really important thing for your clubs to intervene on that. Are you concerned now with your kids all at home and maybe without supervision?
Yeah, so I would say that there's a lot of kids in this community that will need us, and that's why, you know, we are making sure that we're doing the appropriate outreach, whether it's calling the parents directly or reaching out to young people to engage them on social media or working with the local school districts to make sure that there are hot spots in the community for kids to be able to access, you know, Wi-Fi. And so there are a lot of families, particularly low-income families, who may be underemployed or may be working multiple jobs or might be sitting at home. And so we just try to do our part to make sure that the thousands of young people that have come to our clubs in the past, that we continue to engage them and support these families that need us the most. And so we're going to try to do our part to make sure that they're eating healthy, that we're providing virtual programming to support their kids. And then as we learn of barriers, that we also support them. So just for example, you know, we have people who are checking on families, and I met with a donor last night, and they gave us 10,000 surgical masks, the Metcalf family. And so it's just little barriers like that. If you have people going out, you know, checking on families, making sure that they have the support, you know, that they need. As we hear from young people and what their concerns and what their needs are, we're going to try to adjust accordingly and try to meet those needs as our young people sit at home.
Internet access, though, can be a big barrier if that child can't get online or doesn't have a device. What do you do there?
Yeah, it's a huge issue. You know, I know the school district, particularly MMSD, is working on that right now. I was just on a phone conference with all the community center directors, the city, and MMSD, and I believe that issue is going to be addressed in the next week or so, because what I'm hearing from some of the families that if you have a past due bill, that some of the promotions that they're offering right now in terms of free Wi-Fi, that you won't qualify for it. So the city and MMSD is looking to do these hotspots across the region to make sure that our kids are able to log on to Wi-Fi. And it's my understanding that some of the computers that they're purchasing and some of the Chromebooks that they're giving to the kids would also have Wi-Fi capability and will be able to log on from there. So I know they're working on it, and I'm hoping we'll have this addressed in the next couple of weeks.
Oh, so the kids would take their Chromebooks to these hotspot areas in order to use them and get that internet access?
No, it's my understanding they'll be able to use them from home. And they'll be able
okay.
to get internet access.
I see.
And it's my understanding that there's some federal dollars coming down through the state to be able to support municipalities and school districts to be able to do that.
We're talking with Michael Johnson, CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, checking in on how his organization is faring amid the pandemic, how it's reaching out to others. You can join in this conversation about volunteerism and where you're helping out. 800-642-1234. Michael, in Milwaukee County and other metro areas around the country, a disproportionate number of African Americans are testing positive for COVID-19. They're falling ill. What do you make of this pattern? What's driving it?
Yeah, I think that when you look at the number of low-income families, and particularly, you know, I'm an African-American, you know, male, so you look at, you know, Chicago, you look at, you know, state of Illinois, you look at Milwaukee, and you see that people who live in dense, you know, urban areas are being the most impacted. Also, when you look at racial disparities, you know, African-Americans are always at the bottom, you know, of that list, and there's challenges, you know, around that. And so when you look at most of the people who work in these direct service fields, whether it's bus drivers or store clerks or folks who are essential right now, typically are low income, live in low income communities, and are typically people of color. And those are the folks who are the most impacted. And when you look at the disproportionate deaths that's happening across the country, African-Americans right now are the most impacted. So what we have tried to, you know, encourage people, we've been putting out, you know, statements on a regular basis, you know, asking people to, one, practice social distancing, two, that they're eating, you know, healthy meals and drinking a lot of water. Three, that they're, you know, washing their clothes and wearing a face mask, you know, every time that they go out. And then making sure that they're, if they're on medication, that they're, and that their doctor have prescribed and have given them medication, that they're taking it to keep themselves healthy. I know I have friends and family members who have been impacted by the coronavirus. I've also had a staff person that have contracted the virus and have since recovered. So the good news is, on one hand, we've lost a lot of Wisconsinites, over 200 people, but at the same time, it's my understanding over 4,000 people have recovered, and I know at least 6 or 7 people that have recovered from it so far.
In your personal network, Michael, how are your staffers doing? How are they? How are you handling this time for your organization? Are they furloughed?
Yeah, so about we were able to retain about 60%, you know, of our staff, and in some cases with our part-time employees and some of our middle-level managers and some of our senior staff have decided to go on FMLA because some may be single parents who now have to attend to their school, to their kids, and help, you know, homeschool them. We've also made sure that in some cases it made sense. Some of our employees are like, hey, I think I'll probably do better, you know, with the stimulus package, you know, working either from home part-time and collecting unemployment. And so we had to furlough about 40% of our staff, and that was challenging because we've never had to lay, you know, anybody off at Boys and Girls Clubs, at least in my 10 years here. But we also made sure that we were talking to our employees on a regular basis, identifying resources that they can tap into. And then we also raised funds to make sure that each one of our employees that were impacted by this pandemic, that we got them relief. And so we raised enough money to provide up to $1,000 for each one of our employees that were impacted, you know, by COVID-19. And we also identified additional resources for them to make sure that they're getting the support that they need. And then my team is talking every single day through Zoom to make sure that we're getting, you know, critical work that needs to be done in the community. And then we actually have an all-staff meeting this week that we do through Zoom to make sure that I'm communicating with our team on a regular basis.
I wonder, you know, once we're on the other side of this pandemic, do you see nonprofits and volunteerism through a new lens? Because there has been so much collaboration, there has been so much teamwork among nonprofits to be able to get through this time, and social service agencies.
Yeah, so I think that the world that we lived in a month and a half ago, I think will look different in the next 6 months. I believe that a fair share of our nonprofits and small businesses are going to be impacted by this, and contributions across our sector, I think, is going to be down. One out of 10 jobs in Wisconsin come from the nonprofit sector, and a lot of that support comes from small businesses and corporations and individual contributions. And I would make an assumption that those contributions are probably going to go down because of the unemployment rate. And so more now than ever, we're going to have to be creative in terms of how we deliver services to children and families. How do we work with, you know, the small businesses? And then even those folks who were once donors, they now might be folks that we have to provide services to make sure they're getting the help that they need. And that's why when we kicked off this campaign a month ago, we didn't try to go at it alone. We called Selfless Ambition. We called United Way. We called the River City Food Pantry. We called Second Harvest, because it's going to take our collective leadership to ensure those who are impacted by this virus get the support that they need. But at the same time, we also got to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves and that we're taking precaution to make sure that that we're staying safe while we're out there helping people.
Thank you for joining us, Michael.
Hey, thank you for having us.
Michael Johnson, CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, back after this news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being with us. And thank you to everyone who donated during our spring member drive. Support from people like Robert in Eau Claire sustains the trusted news and information you value on the Ideas Network. To ensure the resources are in place, we fundraise throughout the year, which has all been affected at this time. So if you missed the spring drive, your gift now at WPR.org is especially important. And thank you for your support. Right now, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers tracks water levels for the Great Lakes. They are again set to reach record high levels, and we're learning what this means for seasonal flooding. Do you live near a large body of water? Have you taken flood precautions this spring? Have you gotten flood insurance in recent years? How do you prepare? How do you prepare when lake levels are high or heavy rains are expected? We're at 800-642-1234. Chad Berginnis is Executive Director of the Association of State Floodplain Managers. It's a national organization promoting education and policies that mitigate the impacts of flooding, and it's based in Madison. Chad, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Nice to be with you.
So once again, we're hearing about record high lake levels for the Great Lakes. What is causing the reoccurring highs each spring?
Well, you know, the Great Lakes over time fluctuate, and what we tend to see is lake levels be very cyclical. But as you mentioned, we are looking at record high lake levels this spring and this summer, at least. And the causes of that are a little bit complex. Certainly, one of the things that we notice in the upper Midwest is that we are experiencing more intense storms, rainfalls that may be 2 inches or higher. And of course, those kinds of storms tend to generate a lot more runoff that ultimately go into the lakes themselves.
They have to go somewhere.
And
that's really where you get the problems with flooding. How closely are you looking at lake level projections, and how accurate are they?
Well, lake level projections for the Great Lakes are fairly accurate. Given the cyclical nature of lake levels, they've been studied very well for a large number of years. And unlike water levels that are more influenced by individual storms, where the predictions may be a little less accurate, lake levels projections tend to be fairly accurate. So we know that it's coming, and the good news is that gives property owners, I think, a little more time and knowledge to prepare.
Yeah, so property owners and businesses, you know, what should they be doing prior to flood season to prepare for what may come?
Well, you know, it's funny looking out the window. It's just a beautiful sunny day here in Madison. And the very first thing that we can do, especially on days that we're not experiencing flooding, is to check our insurance coverage. Business owners, homeowners, renters all can buy flood insurance. And the importance of buying it now when it's not flooding is that often there's a 30-day waiting period before the insurance itself actually kicks in. And so, again, the easiest thing to do is to contact your insurance agent. Most licensed insurance agents will sell flood insurance. And make sure that you have insurance on either your home, your business, or your contents.
And even if you don't live in a flood-prone area, you should consider this type of insurance?
Absolutely. While we've identified a lot of our flood-prone areas in the country, and even here in Wisconsin, there's a lot that we've not even mapped yet. And so just because a map doesn't show you in the floodplain doesn't mean that you can't flood. And what we also find is that, much like with other insurance, if you're in a lower risk area, the insurance is actually much more affordable. And so outside those map flood zones, you can get a very inexpensive flood insurance policy.
How accurate are the flood risk maps? How up to date are they?
So in areas where the flood studies are newer, using newer flood models and technologies, they're actually quite accurate. But here's the thing about flood maps, is that the flood maps are meant to identify a statistical type of floodplain, something called the 100-year flood. We know that Mother Nature gives us floods that are smaller than that and larger than that. So the 100-year floodplain, I like to almost view it more as a reference point, the fact that, yes, it can get wet here. But again, as we're seeing these increased heavy rainfall events, we could have larger floods, and so folks need to be prepared.
Right. We've heard of 100-year floods, but we've heard of 500-year floods as well. What does that mean?
Well, so the term 100-year flood simply means that a flood that has a 1% chance of happening in any year. A 500-year flood basically has a 0.2% chance of happening every year. But here's how this stuff can change. Down in Texas, after Hurricane Harvey, what was once thought as the 100-year flood, after scientists redid the flood maps and the hydrology in the area, they found that actually what was used to be the 100-year flood is now the 25-year flood. So again, with changing climate conditions, what we're finding is that what we thought was the 100-year flood is happening a lot more frequently. And the folks in Houston, in 3 years, they basically experienced 2 500-year floods and a 100-year flood. So I think the take-home point for folks in Wisconsin is that do not let the terminology fool you. A 100-year flood can happen at any time. And if you've experienced a 100-year flood, you could have another one the very following week, the next month, the next year.
It sounds quite unpredictable, even though there's a lot of science behind it. How often are these maps recalculated?
It does vary in terms of updating the flood maps. For example, if you live in a watershed that there's not a lot of change happening, perhaps a rural part a rural watershed up north, for example, then you may not need to update the flood maps as frequently. But if you have an area that's growing, a lot more homes, subdivisions, shopping malls, and things like that being built, the hydrology, the runoff changes a lot, and so you need to update flood maps much more frequently. So in a case where there's not a lot of change, a flood map that's maybe 10, 20 years old can still be very valid. And in an area where there's a lot of change going on, you may need to be updating those maps, let's say, every 5 years.
We're talking with Chad Berginnis, Executive Director of the Association of State Floodplain Managers. You can join in. Have you suffered damage from significant flooding in recent seasons? What support was available from local government, from federal government? What actions would you like to see government leaders take regarding increased flooding risks in your area? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring in Kim now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Hi. What's up? Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. So if we're having stronger, if we're having stronger storms, it's causing more runoff, and then we're also having more sedimentary water. How is that affecting, like, the E. coli levels throughout the year and the usability of our lakes?
Thank you, Kim. How are the smaller lakes and rivers affected when you have this runoff and this compounding problem of rising water levels?
Well, one of the characteristics that we know of these more intense storms is that instead of more of the water actually being absorbed into the ground, that water tends to pick up contaminants or even fertilizers on the soil and washes them into our creeks and streams and ultimately our lakes. And so just that trend alone is going to result in larger nutrient loads that go into our streams. And of course, those nutrient loads can cause things like algae blooms and those types of things. Similarly, as that runoff can increase other pollutants and contaminants, including, you know, fecal matter even, that can in turn increase our E. coli levels as well. So more intense rainstorm events certainly can increase both situations like algae blooms as well as higher E. coli levels.
And perhaps people who build cabins around our lakes here in Wisconsin should really think about how far they are away from that body of water.
They should, not only for the cabin itself, but think about in those areas that you don't have local water and sewer. And so you need to, for instance, you might need to build a septic system. You need to be very sure that the septic system itself, where all the waste is going to be going, is situated in a way that doesn't increase lake contamination. Very important.
When we see flooding and severe damage to homes and businesses, often people think sandbags, that's the go-to thing. What other technology is out there to prevent water from getting in?
You know, Kate, this is one of those areas that I get kind of excited about, I guess, as a person been in the flood business for over 25 years, is that we have technologies that are so much better than sandbags. Yet when we turn on the television, that seems to be the go-to approach that everybody uses. The Association of State Floodplain Managers has a small program, and we maintain a website called nationalfloodbarrier.org. And this program essentially tests and certifies these better products that basically can function like sandbags but do a whole lot more. And so one of the products, for example, that is tested and certified, and it's hard to visualize, so I'll do my best here, is called the Mega Secure Water Gate. And essentially, it's rolled on a giant spool. It's basically PVC fabric. You unwrap it and lay it on the ground around your home or your business. It's weighted down. And then when the floodwaters come, the floodwaters actually inflate it, and it will protect up to a height of 5 feet around your house.
So using the water to provide that barrier. We have Chad Berginnis as our guide from the Association of State Floodplain Managers. What would you like to know about flood control? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a minute with Chad Berginnis right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at the flooding situation around the state. When the soil is saturated, new rainfall has nowhere to go, and that also contributes to flooding. This spring, the slow snowmelt has kept waters from rising even higher. Do you live near a large body of water? Have you taken precautions? How do you prepare when lake levels are high or heavy rains are expected? Have you had flood damage recently? What support was available to you? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. We have Chad Berginnis with us. He heads up the Association of State Floodplain Managers. That is a national organization based in Madison, and he stays with us. So, Chad, we are talking there about perimeter barriers and specifically the aquafence. What do you see in the aquafence and technologies like it?
Well, what I think the main advantages of these technologies is they're deployable very quickly, and they're also reusable. And what we know about sandbags, for example, is that once they're used, the sand is contaminated, needs to be disposed of properly. And so some of these technologies, literally, you unspool it, you use it, the flood happens, the flood goes down, you hose it off, and you store it again. So they're very efficient. And I think about, you know, with the pandemic, for example, where we need to exercise social distancing and things like that, these technologies could actually even be helpful from that standpoint.
And how much of a barrier do they provide? How resilient are they compared to the old model of sandbagging?
Well, there are more manufacturers getting into this space, and so it's important that these products actually be tested to a certain standard. And so that's why with our National Flood Barrier Program, all of the products have been tested and certified to what's called the ANSI 2510 standard. And so it's just very important. You can look, and basically the mark that you want to see is this diamond with the words FM in the middle of it.
Well, let's take another call now. Kim is with us from Marinette County. Hi, Kim.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm in beautiful Marinette County today where I live, but 10 years ago I lived in Nashville, where on May 1st, 2010, we experienced a 1,000-year flood and 30,000 homes and businesses went underwater. And I learned way more about insurance that I ever wanted to know. I was unlucky in that I let my flood insurance lapse. And as you know, homeowners insurance doesn't cover floodwaters. But something else I learned, because so many people were devastated by it, was that you can experience that and have all that water in your home but still not be covered if you have flood insurance and home insurance. If you have seepage based just on the pressure of the water table, and so many people lost their homes and weren't covered under any circumstance.
Kim, thank you. Chad, what do you know about seepage and water pressure coming into a home that may not directly be flooding itself?
Yeah, so a couple things on that. And here in Wisconsin, even, we definitely have areas where you have high groundwater that can cause this type of flooding. It's important to know that typically flood insurance policies associated with the National Flood Insurance Program, the definition of flood means it needs to be surface water, or at least a flooding condition on the surface. It could be as a result of high groundwater, but you've got to have flood water on the surface. For areas that are subsurface, sometimes what we see is that flood water enters through in the house through sewer backup and those types of things. There is something on your homeowners, usually available through homeowners coverage, called sewer backup. That it's an extra rider that you can get on your homeowners and homeowners policy, that essentially if you get that sewer backup, even if you don't have a condition of flooding out there, that can help pay for damage. So those are the two points I think that are probably most important to pay attention to.
Kim, are you seeing any flooding this season where you are in Marinette County?
No, happily no. When we found our new home site, we made sure we were on very high ground this time.
Well, Kim, thank you for calling in. We're talking with floodplain expert Chad Berginnis as he's with us to discuss and prepare for this season's flood risks, what we can look at amid this time of a pandemic. And as we look at flooding, are you concerned about high water levels? What would you like to learn about precautions for flooding? Join in at 800-642-1222. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Chad, what about flooding, individual flood precautions? How may that be impacted by what we're experiencing with the pandemic right now?
Well, one of the things I worry about, and I'm hoping that, you know, local emergency managers and the folks that help keep us safe during these hazards are thinking about this, is that right now we know that social distancing is an effective strategy and one that we need to take. Yet when we have a flood disaster, whether we have flood fights that happen so that we have people close together, you know, filling and placing sandbags, or we have shelters that open to house folks, we really need to be thoughtful about how we do those things in such a way that also help reinforce the social distancing requirements that we have. So those are, I think, the two primary things that I'm worried about.
Yeah, I mean, because our way we have, you know, fought floods before is shoulder to shoulder with our neighbors, helping our neighbors out when the rising water is coming. And then there's also the National Guard that also helps in these types of emergencies. Do we have the resources in place in case there are rising waters?
Well, and I think that's for all of those that are in charge of those, either those flood fights or, you know, whether it's the state emergency management or FEMA or the Guard. Everybody, I think, needs to be prepared and think about, you know, the fact that in those situations, they effectively are first responders needing things like the personal protective equipment, just like nurses and doctors need right now.
What can communities do to prepare for flooding events? What would you suggest?
Well, there's a couple things, and there's really two main tracks to focus on. What you have built currently that's at risk, and what you have that's going to be built, and the strategies are different. For stuff that exists that's at risk, flood mitigation are the appropriate techniques, things like elevating a building, things like floodproofing, acquiring and demolishing a building. And we have programs here in Wisconsin that can help fund those types of things. The Municipal Flood Control Grant Program, administered by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, provides about $2.5 million a year in funding. You would apply through your community. There's also FEMA programs to help provide funding through their hazard mitigation grant programs, and Wisconsin Emergency Management helps administer those. For things that have yet to be built, the most effective approaches typically are good community planning and strong building codes and development standards. Luckily, in Wisconsin, we have some of the most sensible flood resilience codes in the country. And I think it's just very important that that communities really adhere to those codes, that they don't issue variances to those codes, because we know that the flooding situation, even here in Wisconsin, is getting worse over time.
That we can't let our guard down, that we have to continue to make sure those codes are with the reality of the changing climate.
Exactly.
Can you leave us with anything else in terms of what you're seeing around Wisconsin and around the country that is a success in keeping floods at bay?
You know, Wisconsin in some ways has been a pioneer, especially in flood mitigation. We have communities like Soldiers Grove and Darlington that have implemented at the time some of the first in the nation relocation from high hazard flood prone areas. And I get phone calls from reporters and communities across the country wanting to know how we did that here in the state. So I think the take home message is this, is that even though Wisconsin is a leader nationally in flood loss reduction, we can't let our guard down. And there are strategies that individuals, that businesses, that communities, and that the state can all take to further reduce our flood risk.
Chad, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Chad Berginnis is Executive Director of the Association of State Floodplain Managers. Just ahead, much of America's supply of generic drugs comes from other countries. We look at the supply chain that is affected by restrictions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.